And welcome again to the Ask Beauty Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends, whether or not we are rich or poor or black or white or gay or straight or queer or trans or educated or not or religious or not, the reality is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives. And as I've been telling you now for the past 4.5 years here on the Ask Beauty Show, the very, very best thing that we can all do when we feel that we are on a never-ending roller coaster ride or merry-go-round ride, and not a fun ride, my friends, is that we really do need to give ourselves permission and reach out and ask for help. You know, I was looking at some statistics over the weekend. I mean, do you realize that in the United States, there are over 16 million adults who are suffering from true clinical depression, and that translates into 1 in 5 Americans. And we have a great deal that is lacking in this country when it comes to mental health and mental health treatment. And also, there are 40 million adults suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders in this country. And I was looking at the suicide rates, you know, suicide attempts by young people. I mean, who can imagine young people who are giving up so early on in their lives? It has quadrupled over the last 6 years. And you know that since 2011, there has been a 40% increase nationally by self-poisoning for young people. The suicide rate amongst kids who are ages 10 to 24 increased by 56%. And the homicide rates by so-called intimate partners increased by 26% from 2010 to 2017. This is kind of depressing news, but we have to get real about what is really going on in this country. And 4 women are killed every day by their partner. And of course, if we're looking at the divorce statistics, I keep looking at the divorce statistics every single year. And you would think that with all the self-help books and all the television shows and radio shows that talk about relationships, that we would really see some positive impact when it comes to marriage and relationships and our family life. But that, unfortunately, is not the case. The divorce rate, and I'll ask people this all the time when I'm speaking around the country, and I'll say, okay, what do you think the divorce rate for first marriages is? And most people will say 50%, and well, the latest statistics is that it's 48%. And what do you think the divorce rate for second marriages is? Well, that number goes from 48% to 67%. And what about for third marriages? You would think, we would hope, right, that people would really learn something after having been divorced the first time, the second time. But the divorce rate for third marriages is 74%. And you might wonder, what is really going on? Why can we not seem to get a real handle on our relationships, on our marriages, on our parenting, and on our family life? Well, over the past 35 years as a practicing psychotherapist, and when I say that, it's like, oh my God, how is it possible that I've been practicing as a psychotherapist and sex therapist for the past 35 years. But I've actually defined, and I'm very, very clear about what the issues are. And the first thing, and I know this to be a fact, is that if each of us is really not in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, where we have worked through our early traumas, the depression, the sexual abuse, what did and what did not happen in our family of origins, we are not going to be in a position to be able to find and maintain a healthy relationship with anyone. And I know that this is really not fun. And when people call me for psychotherapy, I mean, they know that it is going to be a really intense experience. And yet, what are the alternatives? If we have all of this unfinished business and what I call skeletons in the closet, we are never then really able to live in the moment. So what ends up happening is that we have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And people will say all the time, well, we can't change history. And that's true. We absolutely cannot change anything that's happened a second ago. But with good therapy, we're able to emotionally work through what did and what did not happen so that the clouds and the gloom are going to be diminished. And by the way, moving forward, at least in my clinical experience, does certainly not mean forgetting. You are never going to forget what did and did not happen in your life. And it also, and this is my perspective on all of this, it also does not necessarily mean forgiving, unless, of course, that is something that you want to do. But number two, so okay, we have to get our own acts together. Number two, what I have found, rich and poor and educated and black and white and Hispanic and Muslim, I think that what I've seen is that the majority of people have simply not learned the ingredients that go into healthy relationships. We don't know. We haven't learned it. And if we were not really lucky enough to see mom and dad or mom and mom or dad and dad in our own family, I mean, we're really left to our own devices to figure this out. And of course, what we're seeing up to this point, we have not figured this out all that well. And number three, and this is something that I'm really proud about. I did research with 450 people in the Providence, Connecticut, and Rhode Island areas. And what I was able to discover, and what I did do, was that I devised a 10-step formula, which actually really works, that has been used by thousands and thousands of people around the world to help people assess and evaluate who's right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. You know, when you think about it, we assess everything in our life. We assess our cell phones. We assess our painters. We assess what kind of computers we should buy and what houses we should be looking for. And yet when it comes to relationships, I think it's a mindset that we've never really learned or we've really never thought about. In fact, before I did the book, because my research actually culminated in my first book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. Before the book and before the research, because I'm a pretty, pretty spontaneous kind of person, I would meet somebody and I'd say, oh, I met this really great woman. I met this really great guy. And after doing my work, I would never make that kind of statement again. So what would I say? Well, the best I could say is that I have met a man, or I've met a woman who appears to be great and trusting and loving and wonderful. And the interesting thing about my research is that what I found was that it takes close to a year to really find out who somebody is and isn't, unless you see a number of red flags that are all outlined in my book, where you need to clearly exit and extricate your relationship as quickly as possible. So was all of this fun? Well, it's not just like going out for dinner or having a tea party. But the reality is that we all really need to educate ourselves. And in the educational process, my friends, we empower ourselves with knowledge. And above all, for the men and the women, and whether or not you're heterosexual or whether or not you're gay or lesbian or you're on the non-binary scale or trans, what ends up happening is that you really do keep yourself safe. In fact, I was in touch not too long ago with Denise Brown, and everybody knows who Denise Brown is. O.J. Simpson married, and then he murdered her sister, Nicole Brown Simpson. And she has said publicly that had Nicole, you know, actually known about my formula and had used the formula, Nicole, like millions and millions of women around the world, would probably be alive today. So hopefully, if you're in a situation, if you're really wanting to learn about relationships, if you have questions about your own relationship, you can always actually call me here on the Ask Beatty Show. The call-in number is 888-874-4888. Just a couple of other things. And I was looking at how many people actually keep their New Year's resolutions. And last week, of course, was the first Monday in 2020. I was just giving you a reminder of all of the things that we actually need to do, not just wish, not just think about, but actually do, to improve the quality of our lives every single day. So just very, very quickly, Gary Noel, he talks about this every day, the importance of plant-based diets and fruits and vegetables and grains and fish and nuts. And in fact, last night, my husband Jim and I, we had shrimp and scampi, and it was in butter. And I said to my husband, I said, what are we doing? And he said, well, you know, occasionally, once in a while, it's okay. Well, I have no plans on having shrimp and scampi in butter again, probably ever. Also, the importance of interaction, social interaction. I'm not talking about social media. I'm not talking about being on our phones and tweeting and looking at our Facebook, and people are doing this continually, and the kids are sleeping with their phones and we are sleep deprived. The importance of face-to-face human interaction, socialization, and of course the importance of sleep, 8 hours of sleep every night. I don't know how many of people these days are actually getting 8 hours of sleep every night. I mean, I'll wake up in the morning and I'll say to Jim, you know what, I just received an email from somebody who was, you know, emailing me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, really, really, this is not in our best interest. And the importance of naps, and of course exercise and weight training, and of course having supportive people in our life, and eliminating toxins. And of course, when we talk about toxins, we think about environmental toxins. When I talk about toxins, I talk about toxic people, and we do not want any toxic people in our lives, including family members. And I'm not suggesting that you just eliminate people, and of course I'm not talking about killing anybody, but if you are in situations where you find that people are not willing to work with you and acknowledge and address and resolve issues as best as one can, where there is rational discussion and compromise and trade-offs, where people are actually looking toward a win-win resolution, do we actually need these kinds of people in our lives? I don't think so. And of course, Gary Noel always talks about the importance of eliminating the sugar and the soda. And I talk a lot about, and Arianna Huffington, we talk about the importance of minimizing the social media and the cell phones and the computers. So are you on board this year with doing what is actually in your best interest? Well, moving on to what I think is the best part of the show today is my guest, Manuel Gomez, who is the People's Private Investigator. And before I introduce him formally and officially, we are going to play Manuel Gomez's favorite song by Nina Simone, Don't Let Me Be Understood. Nina Simone. None of us want to be misunderstood. Manuel Gomez, I am so excited that you are here. And I want you to know, you are the first and only private investigator that I have ever actually interviewed. And when I was thinking this morning about private investigators, I'm thinking maybe a divorced private investigator. But here you are, a former special agent operative. You are the star, and we loved meeting you at the opening here in New York of the critically acclaimed Sundance Film Festival documentary Crime and Punishment, which everybody needs to see. You are a former NYPD police officer with lots of stories to tell all of us, because I know that the audience is going to be maybe a little bit surprised and maybe not, since we are really a progressive audience, about police brutality, illegal stops, questions, frisks, and I was surprised to read about this, how the NYPD has collected over $900 million in what I call and what you call dirty money. And Manuel, along with Frank Serpico, would love to meet him, depicted by Al Pacino in the 1973 Hollywood classic Serpico. You've drafted, so proud of you, legislation, the Civilian Justice Bill, that would finally make the police accountable for their actions. So you're here, Manny.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's absolutely...
It's an honor.
Well, it's an honor for you to be here, because we've really never talked seriously about what you do. We'll go out for dinners, we'll kibitz around, but wearing my psychotherapist hat, I really want to know what it was like for you growing up in the Bronx and how you found this path that you're on so early on.
Well, I grew up in the South Bronx, back in the Grand Concourse on 167th, and went to Cardinal Hayes High School and so forth. And being a young white Latino, you get into a lot of fights.
And you did?
Oh, my God. I got my share. My knuckles are filled with scars from having to defend myself. And you see also a lot of police brutality. I saw a lot of things that made me want to become someone that would help the community. And that's why when I went to school, and I was very fortunate, my mother sent me to Cardinal Hayes High School, which is a Catholic school, graduated from John Jay in criminal justice, and I pursued from there to become an NYPD officer, and at the same time joined the United States Army 18th Airborne Counterintelligence as well, in the reserves. So I was able to try to give back to the community, except when I got into the police department, the first day there, I graduated. I was the happiest man in the world.
I bet.
I'll never forget it. I graduated from Madison Square Garden with like about 2,000 cops, and it was just a feeling I could not even put into words. Mm-hmm. But when I got to my first police command in the 4-3, the first day there, I was standing there with my shoes all shiny, my uniform pressed. I was the proudest man. I felt like Captain America.
Uh-huh.
I was in a room filled with 40 other brand new cops. And we were all eager to have our first day. So one sergeant comes out and goes, you, points to 8 of us, get in my van. We're going to get a felony arrest. And I was like, oh my God, I'm really doing it. And we get in the van, we drive over to Stratford Avenue. It was a place called Yankee Pizzeria, and I'll never forget this.
Mm-hmm.
There was 4 kids there, about between the age of 15 and 18, and they were holding pizzas in front of the pizzeria.
Yeah.
The sergeant goes, get out, throw them all up against the wall.
Wow.
We'll find something. So I'm in the van with 7 brand new cops. I'm number 8. We're all looking at each other. So I said to the sergeant, I says, with all due respect, what am I throwing them up against the wall for? Mm-hmm. And he says, because I gave you an order. And I says, but we just graduated the academy. We're supposed to have probable cause. We have to have a legal reason for putting somebody up against the wall and searching them, not just because they're holding a pizza in front of a pizzeria. I says, what are they doing? Having illegal pizza?
Mm-hmm. So, what a lot of chutzpah. For you to express as a brand new officer that you were going to confront your superior.
And the thing was is that the sergeant was so angry that he said, I gave you an effing order. You better follow it or you're going to get suspended.
Wow.
So I looked at him. All the other cops looked at each other, and I said to him, you just gave me an illegal order, and I will not follow it. And neither will none of these other cops.
So what did the other guys say? I mean, they must have been like, oh, my God, what are we going to do here?
They stood quiet, looked at me, and they backed me.
They did.
So the sergeant said, nobody's going to get out. And we said, no, because you have to have a reason to stop somebody. And at that time, when I graduated, it was the heart of the stop, question, and frisk. Uh-huh. They were throwing people against the wall. We had so many shootings and so forth. And this is a policy that comes from the broken windows policy. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the Giuliani days. And we were still going through all that stuff into the police department, violating people's human rights. And it's not right. And I wasn't going to do that. I didn't join the job to violate people.
So what happened to you? So you and your colleagues, you did not follow orders.
We went back to the police command. The sergeant drove us at maybe 100 miles an hour. And he said, all of you go into the muster room, which is a room where all the cops stand and get their assignments for the day. So now the captain came down, the inspector, and three lieutenants and the sergeant, and they were yelling and cursing and screaming at us, saying, what the hell and effing's wrong with you guys? You've only been 15 minutes on the job, and you're already causing problems. So I looked at them, and we all looked at each other, and I looked at the inspector, and I says, you're asking us to violate people's rights. That's not what we joined for.
Wow.
And we said, if you have a problem, you have eight brand new cops standing here who are willing to testify that you just gave us unlawful orders. Now, do you want to go toe-to-toe with us?
So what did they say? You're rookies.
And he looked at us and he says, are you the leader? I says, no, we're all cops, real cops. So he left the room, the captain, but they didn't know what to say. Okay. I said, we'll go to the news with this. They threatened to suspend us. So they came back in, and they put us all in different locations, separated us, and put us in the most dangerous locations. They put me in front of a mural where the cops were wearing Ku Klux Klan hats, shooting Amadou Diallo. Wow. That was my first post that they put me to stand in front of because of not wanting to violate people's rights. So then my whole career in the reality of what the law enforcement culture was really about was smacked upon me in the first 15 minutes of being a cop.
So let me ask you this, May. Was this really business as usual, what you discovered, what was really going on within the NYPD world?
It is, and it still goes on now. Mm-hmm. And they try to twist it and justify it. And this is the problem. This is the subculture that we need to get rid of, this mentality of them against us and us against them. And this is how they try to make it. You know, they forget we're here to protect and serve. So what happened was I left the police department.
After how many years?
Oh, my God. It was about 14 years.
So you stayed for 14 years and witnessed the reality of what was going on.
Yes, but I never participated. I always was doing my own thing, which was to enforce the law.
How did you manage? How did you manage to kicked out?
I kept getting transferred all over the place because I refused, just like Frank Serpico, to succumb to the injustice and to succumb to abusing people's rights. And now I'm proud to say that the justice I could not give the public as a cop, now I give as a private investigator.
So let me ask you this. After you left the NYPD, you then became a private investigator.
Yeah.
So you went off on your own.
I went off on my own, and I've been very fortunate. Actually, while I was being a private investigator, I was solving so many cases. To date, I'm at 120 cases, no losses. I've freed 120 people, have captured six serial killers, three rapists, and I've rescued now two women.
How did you build, I hate to put it this way, but how did you build your business? How did people find out about you after you left the NYPD?
Well, when I first started the business, I'll be honest with you, I was eating peanut butter sandwiches because couldn't afford the jelly. But what happened was I went to the criminal courts to where the people that I knew were being victimized.
Yeah.
And then I went and I watched the cases and I sat down in each different courtroom and I would go up to the families that I saw needed help and give them my business card. And then I started going to the bail enforcement places where these people were being victimized, and I gave my business card. And I got my break with a company called Array IC Bail Bonds and another one called Alice Bail Bonds. And they hired me to be their investigator. And then that's how I got my first murder case. And then it was called the Inger Javier case. It was about the Trinitarios. And from there, a film guy found me named Stephen Mang and heard about me, you know, taking on the system.
Yes, we met him. Yes.
Yeah, and he was trying to make a film about police corruption and about quota systems. And this is the problem. As a cop, I would never succumb to. You know, what they do is they require police officers to make 35 summonses a month.
Really? So that is understood. Is that kind of the unwritten message, or is it very explicit? Hey, you guys and women, we expect you to make X number of arrests.
Every cop in the city.
Really?
Every cop, every command. And they made it, it's illegal now. As of 2010, it's supposed to be illegal to get quotas. The problem is, instead of calling it a quota system, like they did before bluntly, they literally put the numbers how many you have to get a month. Now they call it performance objectives. So they put a different hat on the pig. It's the same thing, except they call it a different name. Now, if you don't reach the performance objective in getting 35 summonses a month, all right, then they will not give you overtime. They will transfer you. They put you on performance monitoring. They'll make your life difficult. Okay.
Were you really the first or one of the first people to really speak out and expose what was really going on behind closed doors within the NYPD world?
That's correct. I was the one that formed all the NYPD 12 and the lawsuit that for against ticket quotas, which is now in the film called Crime Plus Punishment.
Right. You were the whistleblower. Yeah, I was the one.
I was the one that got them all together and witnessed this as a cop. And that's why I never agreed to be part of that. And I can proudly say, as a police officer, I never lost one case. Every case I had was tried and convicted correctly and properly, and they were criminals. I didn't stop somebody because they're trespassing in a building or walking while being black or walking while being Hispanic or a white guy driving a BMW in a poor neighborhood. What is he doing? These are the kind of things that go on, and they stop people for this. I would not do that. That's why all my arrests were felony arrests. That means they were criminal arrests of guns, narcotics, women being abused. I went after the social crimes that affect our society and destroy the very fabric of our families. That was my main goal as a cop.
And you're saying that, of course, these people were illegally stopped, illegally convicted, illegally, you know, being put up for bail, and of course they wouldn't have had the money to pay the bail.
The film Crime Plus Punishment, which you can see on Hulu, again, it's Crime Plus Punishment, depicts this, and it shows real film footage. There's no acting. Everything is real, showing the crimes happening. And it shows one of my famous cases, Pedro Hernandez, a kid who was being harassed by the detective, David Terrell, and he was harassing him and his partner, Detective Daniel Brady, and the entire community. And what they were doing in the 4-2 precinct was targeting children and arresting them continuously to the point where you destroy their ability to have a future. And these were poor kids, most of them poorly educated, come from poor families, and they were taking advantage of them. And I witnessed this. And when I heard this from the mother, Jessica Perez, I was like, oh my God, it was almost unbelievable. And I had to go and see it for myself. So I did, and I walked the streets and I witnessed it and I saw it. And then I saw the injustice, and I believed it. And then this cop was so dirty that he was telling Spanish mothers and black mothers, if you spread your legs to me, I won't arrest your children.
Wow.
Not only that, he also was caught on film gambling in the street, throwing dice to let people out of his police car. Mm-hmm. I have that on film. It was on Pix 11.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And again, you know, when I took on this case, I says, oh, my God, I started realizing that this kid was being targeted. Now, when I saw his mother was beautiful. So I says, okay, now I can see why the detective was, you know, hitting on her. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, what happened was her son got caught up, and the guy kept pursuing her son because she would not adhere to his advances, his sexual advances of wanting to be with her. So he took it out on her son.
Her son.
And I proved him innocent on 7 cases. The last case, he was arrested, they said, for an attempted shooting. Now, here's the funny thing. I found the video evidence. I found the witnesses. I even found the shooter. The kid was in jail for a year.
Yes.
And while in jail, he almost tried to kill himself. Like you were talking about suicides in the beginning of your radio show.
Right.
And because this is something that happens frequently in Rikers that a lot of people don't talk about. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say they have about a 25% suicide rate there.
It's that high.
It is.
And I can imagine very little, if any, real mental health treatment that goes on.
And then you're talking about a 40% try to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's the scary numbers that's going on here. And so what's going on is I went there to try to get him out of his depression. He still didn't graduate high school. And I said to him, listen, you need to volunteer for all the educational programs. You got to go to school. You got to finish. You just got to ask for tutoring. Do what you got to do. Well, guess what he did? I went there 3 times a week. I would spend 2 to 3 hours with him, all right, to console him. He took my advice. He volunteered, and the kid won a 4-year college scholarship while in jail.
How wonderful. How amazing. You saved his life.
Yeah, because while he was there 12 hours a day, he was in school and getting tutoring, so he was out of the criminal element,
right.
the prison element, and he was in a protective environment, and he excelled. He took this negativeness and excelled, and he became, got his 4-year college degree scholarship. And not only that, he received awards from the Department of Education. This is unheard of.
Unheard of.
All right, and the kid, so now he's out, he's been freed. But then after that, all these people started watching the film, which we just won an Emmy for about 2.5 months ago.
Yeah.
And people were reaching out to me around the United States. So then I found that this problem of ticket quotas, which generates over $900 million a year in revenue.
Unbelievable.
For the city off the backs of our children.
Yes.
Okay, we're generating money for the city, the backs of our children. And I can prove it to you that it's still going on now. You want to know why? Because every police precinct in the city of New York has to turn in a certain amount of summonses.
Every month.
Every month.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that statistical number, it's the same number across the board,
mm-hmm.
which means you have a what? A quota system.
Yeah, I was reading online that in 2017, the president of the NYPD Detectives Endowment Association sent out an email blast advising detectives to avoid any contact with Manuel Gomez. Really? How did that happen?
Well, you know what it is because I've been... all the detectives that I was dealing with the cases, uh-huh. I would video record them and audio record them without them knowing and catch them in lies. And that's how I was winning my cases, showing the police corruption that the detectives didn't care. And I'm not saying every cop is a bad cop,
uh-huh.
but Serpico said it best, and I got to quote him. He said, 20% of the cops are corrupt and 80% want to do good. Let me say that again.
Yes.
80% want to do good.
Right.
But the problem with the police department is to get along, you have to go along.
Yes.
And that's the problem. So even though the other cop will see a crime being committed by one other cop,
mm-hmm.
he'll
mm-hmm.
look the other way.
Yes.
Because he knows if he opens his mouth, he's going to be ostracized and possibly lose his job and be retaliated against.
I want to ask you something. How have you managed? I mean, you are a big guy. You are a really smart guy. But how seriously have you managed to protect yourself from some real harm? I mean, you are a threat to the NYPD. I mean, you
yeah.
have really, you've shown, you've brought out all of their dirty laundry and the realities of what goes on and doesn't go on. I mean, seriously, have you not been
Well, I have been
worried
threatened.
And
yeah, I have had my life threatened.
You've had your life threatened.
And yeah. Many times. I mean, I actually had a cop in the gym, two cops. I didn't know they were cops at first, but I was on a treadmill. And mm-hmm. a guy says to me, you better be careful before you find yourself in the trunk of a car.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And I told him, I says, well, listen, we can step outside and I can show you whose trunk you're going to go in.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't take me up on the offer.
And I know that recently something happened at your apartment, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Just, you know, it's gotten so bad that I've solved so many cases and I've proven so much corruption within the police department, but not just the police department. Would you like to know who is the biggest criminals in the state?
Sure.
The prosecutors.
Uh-huh.
The district attorneys.
Yeah.
I have found so many of them to be corrupt. I've done 120 cases in 7 years, Beatty. Guess how many were prosecutorial misconduct and prosecutorial corruption?
How
86
many?
Of them.
Mm-hmm.
How can we have a system of prosecutors that can lie under oath and nothing happens to them? Do you know that they have immunity?
Well, how can we have a president that lies under oath and that basically up to this point that nothing happens?
But I agree with you on that. But the one thing that we do have, at least there's an impeachment process, an investigation process.
Right.
But the prosecutors don't even have that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They get away with it. And I've had all these cases of prosecutors lying under oath. It got to the point where it was so disgusting and over. And I'm not talking about just New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo, Syracuse, Albany, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Virginia, Texas, Maryland. I was just nationwide. I was getting calls from everywhere, from all around the country to help people. And I realized, I says, wait a minute, something needs to be done. And I thought about Frank Serpico. And Serpico, you know, in the end of the movie with Al Pacino, he talks about needing an independent agency and so forth.
Right.
The problem with Serpico was he asked them and told them what we needed, but he never wrote it. Mm-hmm. And so the city council members gave him a gold shield. They placated him and says, yeah, okay. And that was it. They fired a few bad cops and the system kept going the way it was, except it became more harsh. So now I met with Frank because I won the Pursuit of Justice Award. Frank won the Pursuit of Justice Award back in 1970, I think 71.
Mm-hmm.
I was the second cop to ever win it. And Frank heard about me, and we met. So I told him, I said, listen, Frank, you got two choices. You're either with me or you're with me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he started laughing.
Yeah.
He says, okay, kid, you got a set on you. And long story short, I said to him, I got a proposal that I'm writing for a new agency called the Department of Civilian Justice that will bring oversight over the prosecutors and oversight over the police departments and oversights over the Department of Corrections statewide.
So where is this bill at the moment?
Well, it got introduced on February 20th of 2020. 19.
Uh-huh.
It's bill number 5947. Assemblywoman Natalia Fernandez introduced the Department of Civilian Justice bill.
Uh-huh.
It's the first of its kind nationwide. And ever since this bill got introduced, I've been going to other states. Now I've got Connecticut introducing it, Georgia, Louisiana, Virginia is looking into it, and now recently New Mexico. I got contacted, you're going to laugh about this, I got contacted by a Navajo Indian reservation
uh-huh.
in New Mexico by a teacher there that saw the film Crime Plus Punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, I'd like you to talk to my students, they're journalists. So when I told them about the bill and everything, guess what happened? All the students of the class got together. Now they're taking my bill and they're making it their bill in New Mexico.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
So what can people do? What can my audience do to help move this along? Like, where is it at the moment?
Well, right now it's still in the state assembly, but if your audience can go on my website.
Okay.
And it's called Black Ops Private Investigator. And I'll say it again, Black Ops, BLACKOPS, Private Investigators with an S. You can download the bill from my website.
Okay.
And it's on it as a PDF.
Uh-huh.
And you can please write your council member, your state assembly member, your state senator, and tell them to support the bill, or you're not going to vote for them.
Right, right.
Because nobody's supposed to be above the law.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is, in this country, the person that's above the law the most are the judges and the prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have oversight over everyone.
Absolutely. Is AOC aware of and is supporting your bill?
Well, I actually sent it to her to introduce it. Now, the federal part, I initially started as a state bill, but then when I started working as a private investigator, I started realizing this is a federal problem.
Right.
It's a national problem. And I've been getting called all around. You know, who does a mother go to when her son is falsely arrested mm-hmm. and the prosecutor's lying?
Right. I guess they go to you here.
Yeah, but who do they go to if I wasn't here?
Right.
And a lot of them don't know me.
Right.
But word of mouth has gotten around, you know, in the jail system. I've literally been called by hundreds of prisoners nationwide mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because they heard about me freeing people.
Right.
And I never thought I would say this, but when I became an investigator, I found out that there are so many innocent people in our jail systems that it's mind-boggling.
Probably, you know, and as a relatively new New Yorker, I'm going to make a statement, but I think I'm probably right. Probably not people living on the Upper West Side and on the Upper East Side.
Well,
right?
That's true.
Right. So we're talking about primarily black
socially
and brown
challenged areas.
And, quote, socially challenged areas.
Yes.
Right.
And that's the problem. But this is nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
This is that. And the reason why you have that problem nationwide, and I can tell you why it originates from New York. The largest police force in the entire United States is the New York City Police Department. It is 36,000 cops. It is literally a small army.
Yes.
So all the states copy, I have to take that back, 90% of the states in the United States copy the New York City Police Department procedures. So when you copy the procedures, you're copying what? The problems.
You're copying, absolutely.
And this is why you see the same problem in Maryland, in Virginia, in California with the Rodney King incident.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
see it in D.C. You see it in with the Maryland cops when they were the corruption over there, when they were literally shaking down drug dealers.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing that happened in New York was happening there. You see it in Connecticut, people being shot. I just had a guy now, a young Jewish boy, send me a video of the cops knocking on his door. They kick his door down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank God the Nest video cam he had up caught the whole thing on film with
wow.
audio.
Wow.
And they kick his door down, slam him to the floor, bang his head on the floor. This is all on video.
Why?
All right? Because they said there was calls for help coming from the apartment.
Ah.
When they searched the apartment, the guy was in his living room doing his homework.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody in the house.
And what kind of recourse would this guy have?
Oh, no. It gets better. They broke his door down. They says, well, we're sorry. Somebody will come fix the door.
Really?
Now he's suing. But he showed me the video. It's appalling.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, like I said, you know, not every cop is bad. But you got so much bad being done, and the guys are looking the other way. And if you look the other way, and you didn't do nothing, that makes you just as guilty as the guy who was being corrupt.
Absolutely. So we didn't really learn much after the Central Park 5 situation at all.
Well, you just brought up a good thing. We just had that movie. It's called Now You See Us with the Central Park 5.
Right.
But the one part that everybody forgets, that movie shows that the cops and the prosecutor falsified the case
yes.
against those five kids.
They sure did.
And you know what happened to them? You know what happened to them?
Nothing.
The people of the state of New York had to pay those kids $40 million in reparations for taking away 20 years of their life. Now, granted, they're entitled to that money, and they should get that money. But don't you think that the people that falsified that case should be punished?
So nothing happened to them?
Nothing happened to
really?
The prosecutor.
Really?
Nothing happened to
uh-huh.
the detective.
Uh-huh.
They should go to jail.
Of course.
They took 20 years out of those four human beings' lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. They were raped. They were beaten.
They were raped and beaten.
All right.
Right.
There were so many things happened to them. It's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
But what's even more disgusting is that the taxpayers paid $40
million yes.
and no consequences were given to the people that locked them up there falsely.
To the perpetrators. To the real perpetrators.
That's right.
Exactly.
And that goes back
exactly.
to what I said, who the real criminals were the district attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know what, the corrupt cop might falsely arrest you, but the district attorney will hold you in jail 4 or 5 years knowing you're innocent. See, the problem with our system is that our system is based on plea bargains. 95% of the cases get plead out.
Yes.
Not only does it get plead out, that means people take a deal even though they're innocent because they scare them into it.
Of course.
This happens every single day. Mm-hmm. And people are destroying their futures without realizing it. Mm-hmm. And they're not fighting for their rights. And the other problem we have, the reason why we have this kind of system is because we reward, and I'm going to say it again, we reward our prosecutors for how many convictions they get.
Yeah.
So now if you're a prosecutor and you have 200 cases and you let go 100 because they were innocent.
Doesn't look good.
They'll say, what the heck is wrong with you?
Right.
Why didn't you get them to take a plea? Why didn't you? So even if you say, well, you know what? I'll take a temporary plea and then what happens in 6 months, it goes away. No, that prosecutor still gets a conviction for that. Instead of doing the right thing and letting somebody go when they're innocent. And this is the problem. This is why I wrote the Department of Civilian Justice. This is what Frank and I, Serpico and I, stand up against, this mm-hmm. type of injustice. And then I realized, that's why I went to Alexandria Ocasio's people, and I've been going out to Jerry Nadler's people, Congressman Jerry Nadler as well. I'm in the process of now meeting with them, that this bill is needed federally.
Right, absolutely.
We need it throughout the country. And then, you know, from this bill and this awareness from winning the Emmy for the film, I started getting more cases. And there's a bigger systemic problem, and I'd like to touch base with you, just take a little side turn, if you don't mind.
No, of course.
Sex trafficking.
Yes.
I just had a case now, and there's another reason why we need the Department of Civilian Justice. I had a guy in Colorado, Mr. Gerardo, tell me his daughter, Carolyn, was on vacation, sent me pictures of them in Cancun. Her daughter met a cute guy, all of a sudden disappeared from Cancun. Now, she's an American, okay? Her father's a retired Air Force. Her mother's retired Air Force. Their daughter goes missing for 5 months. He sees the film Crime and Punishment, looks me up. He's Black Ops, private investigators, calls me up, says, are you military? I says, yeah, I'm retired, you know, military intelligence. And he goes, sure. I says, I need your help. My daughter's missing, and this is what's going on. I look into the case, and I find out that they were selling his daughter online in Long Island, in Babylon, in Nassau.
Wow.
And not only that, they were selling her in Maryland and Boston. They were commuting this girl back and forth. And they were selling her on Babylon escorts and Baltimore escorts. These are online sites.
Yes.
And then they were writing reviews of the people that were having sex with her and how much to have sex with her for. How can we have a government and an FBI agency to be so useless to not take action when we have people posting online how much it is to pay for some woman who's been stolen? Now, this family went to all the law enforcement agencies and they got no help.
What did they say?
They wouldn't even take a missing persons report because they said she was 24.
Oh, my.
The father tried for 5 months. Mm-hmm. I looked for her for 11 days, and I found her.
You found her. How is she?
Oh, my God. I rescued her.
Oh, my God.
I rescued her from the sex traffickers in Long Island. I got into a whole big fight with them, and I got them back, and I scared the living hell out of them, and they gave me her. They literally gave me her.
Well, she must be a basket case.
Well, they were injecting heroin between her toes.
Uh-huh.
And this is what made her able to perform the acts that she was doing.
Yeah.
They made her into an addict. But they were doing it between the toes, so there were no marks left. So nobody wants to have sex with a junkie.
Right.
So they were injecting you in an area where nobody would check. Who's going to check in between your pinky toe mm-hmm. of your feet? Nobody.
So what happened to the people who stole her, took her?
Well, what happened was I found her online.
You did?
In a picture, yeah.
That's amazing.
I went looking for about 3 weeks, and I was looking through all these sites to see if they posted her, and I did. I found her. I tracked all the way to New Hyde Park in Long Island on Covert Street. All right. I'm not going to give the house number, but that is the street, Covert Street.
Uh-huh.
All right. And what happened was, as a matter of fact, I will give the house number, 714 Covert Street. And that was the house that they were running the prostitution stuff out of.
So what happened to the people who were running the house?
Well, what happened was I found her on the website, and then I found her on an Instagram. And then I found her upload a picture of her at the hospital.
So they were stupid enough to put this all online on social media.
That's right. So I went to the hospital in NYU, and guess what? She was there that morning. And then I said, well, you know, the HIPAA laws won't let you, you know, get the information.
Right.
So I did it the old-fashioned American way.
You stole the charts.
Nope. I did it better.
What did you do?
I went to an Italian bakery and I bought an apple pie and a cherry pie.
Oh, my God.
And I walked into security and I said, I want to thank you guys for the great job you did. My mother was here 2 weeks ago. You guys are amazing. And guess what they did? They ate the pie. They were loving it. I was bragging about them. Supervisor came down. He took me to see the video. I asked him if I could see the video system in the hospital.
They didn't know who you were.
No. Uh-huh. And when he took me in, then I eventually, after I got up in there, I identified myself. And they says, oh, we can help you. And I said, I want to see if this girl was here. They showed me and I sat her on video. She was there.
Mm-hmm.
So then I says, well, how do I get the information where she's staying or what goes on? She had to check in and put some kind of name, right? They had her on video with a guy, some guy who looked like the Sons of Anarchy, Italian guy with a big beard, like one of the Grateful Dead guys. And he was paying her bill. Well, guess what he did?
What did he do?
He put his real address on the bill. And that's how I got him.
What did you do then?
I went straight to call the father from Colorado. And I told him he needs to get on a plane ASAP. I found where his daughter's at. He flew down immediately. Like about 4 hours later, I stood by the house and I was watching the home to see if she would come out. Within 6 hours, her father showed up from Colorado. He was in a rental car. I told him, wait down the block, just watch me. I went and banged on the door. I listened first, and he could hear people inside. Nobody would open the door. But I heard them in there. So I said, I'm here to get Carolyn Gerardo back. If you don't give me her, I'm not going away. I'm going to tear down this house, and I'm going to have the police kicking your doors. So I threatened them a little bit.
Uh-huh. I bet you did.
And then guess what happened? After about 5 minutes, the guy from who looked like the Sons of Anarchy that paid her bill shows up behind my Hummer. Gets out and goes, were you in my house? Were you banging on my door? And I says, you're damn right I was. And I says, I want Carolyn. Who the hell is Carolyn? He kept telling me he didn't know who she was. Mm-hmm. It was a lie. I had him on video. We're screaming and cursing each other back and forth. Made such a scene. Now this area in New Hyde Park is a white area, upper middle class.
Right.
Average house there is between 500,000 to 700,000. Okay? And guess what happens? The neighbors called the who? The police.
They did.
And 5 cop cars showed up like if Bin Laden was at the scene.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because it's Long Island. And when they showed up.
It worked in your favor. That's for sure.
Well, what worked in my favor was the guy who's the Sons of Anarchy looking guy. He drives off, goes into the house, runs into the house. The cops come. And the big cop goes, hey, we hear there's a big fight out here. What's going on? And you're here. And the guy looks at me, Hispanic cop, and he goes, wait a minute. You're Manuel Gomez, the private investigator, crime and punishment, comes over and shakes my hand. Next thing you know, all of them are hugging me and thanking me.
Yeah, you did their job.
So I said to him, I said, listen, guys, I need your help. I said, I'm here to rescue a girl. And they says, well, we don't have no proof. We can't go in there. I showed them all my evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we can knock on the door. So they knocked on the door. The guy came to the door, but he wouldn't open it. Now the cops knew that this is kind of funny. Because
mm-hmm.
in Long Island, the normal person's going to open the door and say, hi, officer, what can I do for you?
Right.
They refused to open the door. So the cops come back and says, really nothing else we could do. I said, well, guys, can you do me a favor? And they go, like, what? I says, can you put your cars around the house and put your police lights on?
They did.
They did.
They did.
And I asked them, can you stay here for as long as you can? They stayed with me for 3 hours.
Uh-huh.
Now, everybody that walked by that house, I kept saying, there's prostitution going on. There's drugs in this house. Mm-hmm. I made such a scene that the sex traffickers.
They let her out.
Let the girl call the father.
Wow.
This was the first time she called the father in 5 months. And she said, Dad, I'm not being held hostage. And she's crying. Mm. She said, well, where are you? How do you know what we're doing?
Yeah, right.
So I said, whoever's listening on this phone, if you don't send her in an Uber in the next 10 minutes, I'm going to kick your door in. And we're going to get her legally. Now, could we have done that? No.
Probably not. Listen, Manny, Manuel, I can't believe it. Our hour has come and gone. We have so much more to talk about.
I'm sorry.
This girl needs a lot of mental health. I would love to work with her, actually. It's really true.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody like this who's been through this kind of trauma can't just, you know, come out and be okay.
Well, the good thing is they put in an Uber. They gave it to me.
Well.
And she came crying, and we sent her back to Colorado. She's in rehab now.
Yeah.
But the sad thing is that this is something that's ongoing in our system.
It is ongoing.
And you know what? I will let the family know so you could speak to her.
No, absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
She needs that help.
She's going to need some long-term treatment. Listen, Manuel, I'm so glad that we had this opportunity to speak. We're going to be able to speak off air and on air, I'm sure, many, many more times.
It was an honor to be here.
I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
We love you. We love what you're doing, and people really do need to contact their legislatures and make sure that this civilian justice bill is going to move forward.